Welcome to yet another episode of Oncology for the Inquisitive Mind, the only show you need for your daily dose of oncology knowledge, banter, and lame jokes. I'm Michael, and as usual, I'm here with my co-conspirator, Josh. How are you today, Josh?
Very good, and I've got all the lame jokes ready to play today, Michael.
Fantastic. So, as we said in our last episode, our subject today is melanoma. Specifically,
If those want to know what's in the background, that is Michael's dog wanting lots of attention.
Yes, apologies. Oh, here he comes.
I mean, we could keep all this in.
Yeah, we could keep all
it
this
It would
in.
Just be this weird, like, melanoma and dog episode.
Melanoma and dog episode with a special episode from Beans.
Well, why don't we circle back to actually what we're talking about? Tell me more about melanoma, Michael.
So melanoma has been, as everyone with even a passing interest in the subject knows, revolutionized by the development of immunotherapy and the combination BRAF and MEK inhibitors. However, they don't work for everyone. About 50% of people still die within 5 years from their advanced melanoma. And so further therapeutic options are required. And it can be quite challenging, and Josh, you can attest to this, it can be quite challenging treating a patient who has progressed on immunotherapy plus minus BRAF inhibitors, if that's appropriate.
That's exactly it. You know, it's always the struggle of a trainee or even a specialist. Like, you've got your first line treatment, but what's next? If you look at the survival rate, I think if you go back 5 years, 10 years before immunotherapy, it was abysmal. You essentially got your affairs in order with melanoma, and that was the end of the journey. But Michael, what is the first line gold standard treatment these days?
Well, the gold standard treatment for advanced melanoma, and this is regardless of BRAF mutation status, is immunotherapy, ideally with a CTLA-4 PD-1 blockade with ipilimumab and nivolumab. And if they have a BRAF mutation, you can use a combination of BRAF and MEK inhibitors as second line. But there was a study, I forget the name now, but there was a study that demonstrated that patients who got immunotherapy first and BRAF inhibitor second did better than if the sequence was reversed.
Yeah, so that's really interesting. And so you're sitting down with your patient, you've given them their first line. What's next? Like, what are your options? What's in your arsenal?
And this obviously goes double for patients without a BRAF mutation, because immunotherapy is pretty much all they have.
That's it. And so I always used to struggle in my early days of training. I'm like, all right, I know what to do first. And then I'm like, and then, you know, there's nothing next. And so thus our topic for today is second-line treatments in melanoma.
Yes, took us about 5 minutes to get there, but now we are there. And so, Josh, would you like to leap into this discussion with your trial, which is LEAP-004?
Yeah, not 007, it's 004. You know, once again, Georgina Long is the final author on this paper, who is an absolute powerhouse of melanoma. She is the god amongst men, I like to say, and women, in the land of melanoma.
Recent recipient of the Order of Australia, Medal of the Australian of the Year Award for her, I was going to say tumultuous, but practice-changing work in this space.
It's practice-changing. So let's talk a little bit about the background. Michael's already covered the first section I wanted to talk about. But, you know, what do you do with melanoma, A, if it recurs, or B, if you require additional therapy? There's this thing called immunotherapy resistance, and I never thought of it as resistance, just things stop working. But essentially, you've got, it's multifaceted. It can occur as a primary or secondary resistance. Primary resistance being you just don't get benefit and we don't really know why. And secondary resistance is essentially you've got a period of stability and then it stops working.
And if anyone wants to read more about this topic, there is a post on our Oncology for the Inquisitive Mind newsreel. You can read all about it at inquisitiveonc.com.
You can potentially leap over there.
You could leap over there right now, exactly.
And so the background of the LEAP trial is that we needed further treatments. This is a trial looking at next line of treatments. So looking at the evidence before I talk about the trial, lenvatinib, you know, tyrosine kinase inhibitor, is thought to shift the tumor microenvironment to an immune stimulatory state by inhibiting vascular endothelial growth factor receptor, that's a mouthful, and fibroblast growth factor receptor, but modulating the area around the tumor itself to create a environment that's positive for our treatment. That's really what it is. And the mouse model showed some pretty good promising results. And there was early phase one and phase two studies that did show some benefit of lenvatinib, which is only about 9% of an objective response rate. And then in those that had received less than two prior lines of therapy and in combination with pembrolizumab, that jumped up to about 48% objective response rate in the very early studies. But let's look at our trial, LEAP-004. It's lenvatinib plus pembrolizumab with confirmed progression on immunotherapy, and it's given as monotherapy or in combination. Now, it's a phase two study, which is something to keep in the back of your mind for when we talk about limitations of the study. But essentially, the primary endpoint was objective response rate, how many patients had a response to this therapy, and the secondary endpoint was how long did it work, what was the progression-free survival, overall survival, and safety. Median follow-up at the current analysis, from what I found for the latest data, is about 15 and a bit months, up to the maximum of 19 months. So a single arm, 100 people were aimed to be enrolled. It was multinational. It's a classic inclusion, Michael. You've got to have confirmed melanoma, unresectable stage 3 or stage 4 melanoma, not amenable to local therapy, have measurable disease, have had progressive disease within 12 months of last anti-PD-1, so that's those that are having secondary resistance, and have had at least two doses of treatment, and at least 3 dates of images required prior to having confirmed progression of those that wanted to enroll within the study. I think what they were trying to exclude is rapid progression or hyper-progression, which is understandable that if you want someone on a trial and they're going to not respond irrespective, you're never going to know if the drug's going to work because their tumor is just so aggressive and so rambunctious, it's just going to keep pushing ahead without any sort of effect of anything we give them.
A great word to describe a tumor there, rambunctious.
That's it. Okay, and excluded uveal melanoma does not respond to classical immunotherapy the way that we like it. Unstable angina, heart problems, active brain metastases were excluded, but if they were asymptomatic, had less than 3 brain mets, and they were less than 1 centimeter, they were allowed to sort of be included.
So Josh, do you want to elucidate as to why the authors excluded a lot of patients who had cardiac toxicity? Because you've got New York Heart Association class 3 or 4, heart failure, unstable angina, cardiac arrhythmias, or previous history of MI or CVA.
Isn't it lenvatinib has lots of cardiac toxicities? And, you know, these guys are already on a second line. If you end up knocking their heart off early on, it's going to flatline your trial.
Well, yes, flatline your trial and the patient, to put it crudely. Lenvatinib is also notorious for bumping up your blood pressure. So if you've already got stenosed vessels in your heart, kidneys, or brain, because they mentioned CVA as well, you're going to be at a significant risk of problems if your blood pressure is suddenly bumped up to 190.
That's it. And the only things from the characteristics I want to mention today, BRAF mutation was found in about 36% of the patients. PD-1 positivity was at least 64% of the patients. And prior lines of therapy, about a third had greater than 3 lines, 25% had 2 lines, and 41% had just 1 line of therapy. Most patients had some form of prior immunotherapy, like 91%. So that's sort of where we worked at. So things to know, treatment schedule, lenvatinib was started at 20 milligrams and pembro at the standard dose of 200 every 3 weeks, continued until progressive disease, unacceptable toxicities. Let's jump to the results. 103 patients were included in the trial. They were recruited in about 8 months, so well done for that. That's a fast recruitment. And median follow-up time was 15.3 months, which I've mentioned. And at the time of cutoff, 82.5% of patients had discontinued treatment, 60% of those due to progressive disease. Looking at the confirmed objective response rate, about 21.3% up to 30% maximum. 3 patients had a complete response and 19 patients had a partial response. When you go into the subgroups, because I love a good subgroup analysis, Michael, those that objective response rate was found in about a third of patients in those with progressive disease on prior PD-1 plus anti-CTLA-4 therapy. So that's the combination of ipilimumab and nivolumab that Michael mentioned at the start of this conversation, and the 13.3% response in those who had previous BRAF MEK directed therapy. So interesting, there's a difference in that. And as Mike also mentioned at the start, immunotherapy is the gold standard as the first line, irrespective of a BRAF mutation. 0% of those who had prior anti-CTLA-4 therapy responded. I'm not sure why.
And that's interesting.
That is just an interesting thing. 18% response rate in those with primary resistance, 22% response rate in those with secondary resistance. So that's quite an interesting conversation. Duration of response was about 8.3 months up to a maximum of 15.9. About a third of patients had more than 9 months of response. Interesting to look at the response. So they've done an iRESIST with the investigator review and then RESIST by blind and independent clinical review. And these numbers were different. And so that's something that I wanted to flag as a limitation of the study. And I know it's a small study, but, you know, there's 7 extra people that have supposedly responded in a local investigator review. You know, the range was somewhat similar, but the kind of the response of greater than 9 months was far higher in the local reviewer cohort than the blind independent clinical review, which does show a mismatch of maybe real-world assessment versus trial assessment. And so that's something to kind of, I think, flag at this point in time.
It's also worth noting that there, and we might sort of do an episode or a newsreel post on this at some point in the future, but there are a couple of differences between RESIST and iRESIST. And I can attest to the fact that iRESIST is not necessarily standardized across different studies and different institutions, which makes it difficult.
That's it.
So that could also account for at least part of it, but the discrepancy is definitely worth noting.
That's it. And so overall survival at the 12 months, about half of the patients were still alive, and the BICR, so the independent clinical review that was blinded, progression-free survival at 12 months was only 18%. I mean, still something, you know, still something, but obviously not there. So Michael already jumped in and told everyone the biggest toxicity, but that was hypertension. For some reason, I have missed one of my documents looking at the adverse events, but there were quite a few. 96% of patients had at least an adverse event. The most common was grade 3 to 5, which was 45.6. There was hypertension, diarrhea, and nausea. And looking at my other toxicities, you know, hypothyroidism, decreased appetite, you know, you're looking at half of the patient population having a hypertensive issue, 36% of the population having diarrhea, 33% having hypothyroidism, and I think 5 people died due to a variety of sort of complications from this treatment.
Yeah, it's very common to have patients monitored for a period of time when they start and to organize home blood pressure monitoring or educate the patient to monitor the blood pressure themselves. I've had patients who come into clinic and they have books and sheets and stuff of blood pressure measurements because they're taking it 3 times a day and have done for the past month. Had one patient come in with all of that in graphical form, which was very interesting.
Amazing.
But hypertension, fol-invatinib, no matter where you use it, is something that needs to be monitored.
And I do have it here. So, you know, the average dose here for lenvatinib was actually 15 milligrams, you know, 75% of the required dose. And I've also seen it. Everyone has a dose reduction.
Yeah, yeah. I was actually going to ask what the rate of dose reduction was because it's very, very common in clinical practice.
Stole it right out of your mouth, Michael.
Yes, you did.
And so 4 people died, not 5. Low platelet count, 1 from arterial thromboembolic events, 2 from sepsis. To move on to just the poignant discussion points, I think there's a couple of things to highlight here. You know, first of all, the blinded independent clinical review, the way that the RESIST was done, you know, the no response in the CTLF4 group. Why is that? We don't know. It'd be interesting to see. There was a thing in the discussion also saying that all of these second line studies, there's not a lot of standardization, so you can't actually compare trials either. Not that you should ever compare trials, but it is nice to be able to see this is definitely better than B or C. So there's something like that. But I think, you know, despite that, in saying that, it's still potentially a second line option for some patients, especially if they're young and robust. Or maybe a trial would be the other option that I would consider in this cohort of patients. Real limitations, it's a phase 2 study. You know, I'm assuming it didn't move to a phase 3. I couldn't find anything online looking at LEAP-004 that was turning to a phase 3, but it's a single arm.
Single arm, no comparator. Phase 2 study is a big limitation because we don't know if placebo is any better in this cohort.
That's it. Michael, I'm going to stop talking for once. Why don't we jump across to your TIL study?
Yes, so this is a fascinating one. Just before I jump in, I will seize on something that you mentioned, and we should have probably mentioned this at the top. If you have a patient that is in the unfortunate situation where they have melanoma that has progressed on their first or second line therapy, then clinical trials are a major consideration. So rather than exploring pembrolizumab with lenvatinib, there is always the option and should be heavily considered of clinical trials. So reach out to your local clinical trials unit, friendly neighborhood clinical trials.
That's it. Spider-Man. It's always a Spider-Man.
It's always Spider-Man.
And the other thing to note is that in Australia, you can't actually reuse immunotherapy unless someone's willing to pay for it. And the data doesn't really support re-challenging in a lot of cases.
Exactly. So it's still a very tricky space. Yeah. The prospects for patients who have progressed through established treatments with melanoma is still very grim, but there are potentially some options on the horizon. One of those, and I chose this purely for the scientific wow factor.
Is, wow.
Yes, thank you,
Josh. You can call me Owen.
Yeah. Yes. You tried your hardest. Down. Boy. This study is a study that examines tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes. Now, TILs as an entity is something that we have been aware of for quite a while, and particularly in malignancies like breast cancer, is starting to gain traction as a prognostic marker, as a marker of benefit for immunotherapy, the idea being if you have more tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes in the tumor microenvironment, you are potentially in line for a better response to immunotherapy because the immunotherapy has more stuff, more material to work with.
I think the bigger picture of what you've just said is what are the markers that will help guide us who should receive this treatment and who, like lenvatinib and pembro, will still respond in that second line setting.
You're exactly right. But
Michael, you're also exactly right.
There's so much going right on this podcast. We'll gloss over the stuff that's going wrong. What this study actually looks at, though, is weaponizing tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes themselves. And so from a scientific perspective, it's pretty interesting. We've gone through the background of immunotherapy. One thing we didn't mention is that ipilimumab alone can be considered a later line therapy option. And Josh, I did look at this. If you sort of take the exact wording at face value on the PBS, the Drug Restriction Authority in Australia, it actually is covered.
Yeah, that's true.
As a single agent therapy and in terms of a re-challenge or I think they call it a re-induction option.
Yeah, it's only 4 cycles, so you're kind of done after that.
Exactly. But that is pertinent to know because this TILS study, unlike LEAP-004, is a phase 3 trial with a comparator arm, and that comparator arm is ipilimumab, 3 milligrams per kilogram for 4 cycles.
Oh, shots fired.
Shots fired. Let's get into it. Indeed. So the background to this is that adoptive cell therapy with tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes represents a personalized autologous treatment. It involves the ex vivo, so out of the body, outgrowth and expansion of tumor-resident T cells and adoptive transfer of these cells following lymphodepleting chemotherapy. Already, it's sounding very intense, very hematological, you might say.
Well, I think melanoma yeah, I don't want to say it's hematological, but all of our cancers that respond really well sort of have snippets of the hematology world with them. Michael, what's the method? How did they do this?
Yeah, so as mentioned, this was a multi-center open label phase 3 trial that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2022. It was conducted at 2 centers in the Netherlands. So when they say multi-center, they really mean dual center, but anyway, technically right. Patients were randomized 1-to-1 to receive either TILS therapy or ipilimumab. Before we go ahead, I would like to speak about what TILS therapy in this case actually mentioned. We mentioned it briefly before, but it is a very, very interesting process. So patients underwent a metastectomy for the retrieval and expansion of a population of TILS. So in addition to the extra therapy, patients had to undergo an invasive procedure, something to think about. They then had a hospital admission for non-myeloablative lymphodepleting chemotherapy, which we'll go into in a second. Then this was followed by a single intravenous adoptive transfer of TILS, followed by subsequent high-dose interleukin-2 every 8 hours for a maximum of 17 doses. It's noteworthy. Obviously, this is not something you can do in the day unit, so patients were admitted for the duration. The lymphodepleting chemotherapy that patients received was cyclophosphamide 60 milligrams per kilogram daily for 2 days and fludarabine 25 milligrams per meter squared daily for 5 days intravenously. And for any hematologists or dual trainees that are listening, this is very similar to the regimen that is used in preparation for bone marrow transplants. So again, very hematological methodology. The inclusion criteria for this study, patients had to be greater than 18 years old. They had to have histologically confirmed, unresectable or metastatic stage 3C or 4 cutaneous melanoma, so uveal melanoma obviously excluded. They had to have one or more lesions that could be surgically removed for the generation of TILS with residual measurable disease after resection for evaluation of response. So it's a bit of a mouthful. Basically, they had to have enough disease that cutting out the cancer would not render them unevaluable by RECIST, but they also had to have disease that was accessible to resection. They had to have an ECOG performance status of 0-1. You would not want to try this on a patient with poor ECOG performance status. I feel like that would go terribly. And interestingly, they had to have a serum LDH less than or equal to 2 times the upper limit of normal. LDH in melanoma is a crude tumor marker. It's a risk factor. And so
For poor prognosis.
So they're excluding patients with a huge degree of risk, I guess, from the point of view of an LDH. Just a little small thing to notice. And this is going to be a major discussion point about this trial because of when it was actually recruited. Patients had to have either 0 or 1 previous lines of systemic treatment in the advanced disease stage. So some of these patients were actually untreated for their advanced melanoma.
Okay. It'd be interesting to see that breakdown, Michael.
Yeah, exactly.
It's good signposting right here, guys. Remember this point.
Yes. This is how you podcast. Patients were stratified according to their BRAF V600 mutation status, how many lines of treatment they had, and which treatment center they were at. The endpoints, the primary endpoint was progression-free survival according to RECIST 1.1, and the secondary endpoints included PFS according to iRECIST. There's similar to the LEAP study, they are slightly different. The complete response rate, the overall survival, the health-related quality of life, and safety.
So it's pretty standard.
Pretty standard in terms of the study design, very not standard in terms of what's actually been given. The demographics for both patient populations were fairly well balanced. I will note that there was a greater percentage of men compared to women in the control group compared to the TILS group. About 82% of patients in both arms had an ECOG performance status of 0. A little over half of patients were BRAF mutation wild type, and the majority of patients had stage 4 disease. And amongst the patients with stage 4 disease, most of them had M1C, that is non-CNS sites of visceral metastases that extend beyond the lung and soft tissues, which is M1B and M1A, respectively. In terms of previous systemic therapy, about 11 to 12% of patients in both groups had not had previous systemic therapy, so completely untreated. And in terms of type of previous systemic therapy, 27% of patients in the ipilimumab group, 20 in the TILS group, had had only adjuvant anti-PD-1 therapy, and about two-thirds of the remaining patients had had PD-1 therapy in the first line for their advanced disease.
Interesting.
So it is a fairly untreated cohort, certainly more than I was expecting. I was expecting these patients to have had every treatment under the sun.
Yeah, but I assume, as we said earlier on, going for a trial is really the next best option. Exactly. But also interesting to see the breakdown of those that had adjuvant versus really metastatic therapy. So it would be an interesting point over time to see how people sort of rationalize this, because this is another big question in lots of our treatment. You give adjuvant, can you then give further treatment in the metastatic? We don't have huge data to support outcomes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, just really curious.
Yeah, it's a very interesting study, and one that
generates lots of hypotheses.
Foments a lot of discussion, yeah.
Lots of questions.
So the median follow-up in this study was 33 months, so quite a robust follow-up period. About 80 patients were enrolled in both arms. There are a couple of things that I should note, more from a biological perspective with regards to the TILS process and some of the pitfalls. So they initially enrolled 83 patients to receive TILS, but three were excluded. One patient had insufficient TIL growth, which obviously is a risk for this process. If you have a metastectomy and then you can't grow the TILS on that tissue, do you abandon? Do you go to do another metastectomy? Obviously would be a discussion based on individual patients. One patient had rapid clinical progression, not really much you could do about that. And one patient, interestingly, had a late response to previous therapy. Again, the vicissitudes of immunotherapy strike again, where patients were thought to have progressed or not responded, and then all of a sudden things are getting better.
The modern miracle that is immunotherapy.
Yes, the fickle miracle. In terms of the progression-free survival, the primary endpoint, this was met with a median PFS in the TILS group of 7.2 months compared to 3.1 months in the control group, with a hazard ratio of 0.5, and this was statistically significant. The six-month PFS rate was 52.7% compared to 21.4%. In terms of iRECIST PFS, this was similar, but again, there were subtle differences, similar to what Josh was talking about with LEAP. The PFS in the TILS group was 6 months compared to 3.2 months with a hazard ratio of 0.56. The overall response rate was 49% compared to 21%, but interestingly, there was a 20% complete response rate, which is very much in line with a lot of the first-line immunotherapy trials.
Which is pretty... I just want to stop here for a moment and appreciate these numbers. Like, I don't know if you're going to go into a breakdown of those that had adjuvant versus had metastatic, et cetera, but a response rate as a second-line therapy of 50%, even if it's not that durable, still pretty robust.
Well, yes, and it gets better because that response was seen to be durable. If you look at those curves, the curves do flatten, and they flatten quite significantly.
So, Michael, I know you say they flatten, but what did the overall survival look like?
That's a great question, Josh, and definitely not reading ahead in the notes. So the overall survival in the TILS group was 25.8 months, so that's over 2 years on later line therapy. And of note, the upper limit was not reached. So
people again, are still responding.
People are still responding at time of database cutoff. This was compared to 18.9 months in the control arm, hazard ratio of 0.83, but because it was a secondary outcome, we don't have a p-value.
That's annoying.
The two-year overall survival was 54.3 compared to 44.1 months. And post-hoc analysis suggested better outcomes in BRAF mutant patients. And again, if you look at the curves, you mentioned this before, there doesn't appear to be too much difference in patients who had disease in the adjuvant or received treatment in the adjuvant compared to the metastatic setting, which is interesting. In terms of safety, this also makes for very interesting reading because by the CT-CAE guidelines or criteria, that's the criteria that clinical trials use for reporting of adverse events, 100% of patients in the TILS group had a grade 3 or 4 adverse event. Now, this is probably the only time we can say that this was deliberate and intended, because for most of those patients, it was neutropenia, lymphopenia, decreased white cell count, decreased platelets, everything that you're actually trying to achieve with the therapy.
Yeah, it's interesting that they consider that an adverse event, whereas a desired outcome?
Well, yeah, I guess by the letter of the law, if you're going to run a trial, you have to abide by certain laws and, oh, not laws, but conventions. And it is an adverse event. There was also a significant rate of febrile neutropenia. It was about 86% in the TILS group. So significant hematological toxicity. But again, that is by design.
I smell hematology. I just smell hematology all over this.
Yeah, well, it is. I think the whole approach and the whole process was developed by heme. But it's also sort of similar to what's used in refractory testicular cancer, another pseudo-hematological malignancy that we deal with. And so that's sort of, we take that as red. In terms of non-hematological toxicity, the main culprits were nausea at 86%, fatigue at 61%, and hypophosphatemia at 61% as well. There was a significant incidence of electrolyte imbalances, predominantly phosphate, magnesium, and calcium. Interestingly, there was not a significantly high rate of liver dysfunction, and there were lower rates of rash, LFT derangement, anorexia, and abdominal pain compared to the ipilimumab group. Yeah. Haven't really gone through the toxicity of ipilimumab. We all know roughly what that's going to look like. And from that perspective, the toxicity of this TILS therapy is less. And it's obviously over a more condensed time period because the therapy occurs over the course of, I think it was about 4 weeks for TILS compared to 12 weeks with ipilimumab.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, of course.
Did they give a breakdown of responses in those that had adjuvant therapy versus those that had progressed on metastatic?
So they didn't give a breakdown per se. I think there were fairly few numbers at risk in the adjuvant, which makes a comparison difficult. There was a subgroup analysis. The range is very wide and crosses the line of equivalence. In the metastatic setting, the benefit was much more robust.
Yeah. The interesting thing to just highlight, and I know you haven't finished talking, but if I might interject and take over, is if
I don't think I can stop you even if I wanted to.
Well, it's just if you look at the Relativity 047 data, which is just another option of treatment in really the first line setting, and then you look at the response rates of this particular trial versus, you know, this other sort of first line setting, it's incredible. Because you've got 20% durable response, 50%. What was the other terms you used, Michael? Like 50% that we saw.
2 year survival was 54%. 6 month PFS was 52%. Response rate was 49%. And complete response rate was about 20%.
Because like the progression free survival, this is 12 months, was 47.7%. So you've essentially got, it's just the numbers are in this trial actually incredible.
Yeah. And it's worth noting, again, I mentioned it just before, but this is a relatively short duration of treatment and then what is looking like a prolonged and durable response.
Yeah.
Now, all of this is sounding fairly grim, and so I think it was very good and probably very brave of the authors to put in a health-related quality of life survey, because you would expect the TILS group to be fairly miserable, and to be fair, they probably were for a lot of that time.
The 4 weeks.
The 4 weeks of which they were getting their treatment. However, the quality of life surveys, the TILS group scored better in the global physical functioning and emotional functioning domains. They reported lower symptom burdens of fatigue, pain, and insomnia. However, there were higher symptom burdens of nausea and vomiting.
Yeah.
Which, you can't win them all. Also, some data on subsequent therapy in the TILS group. 32% had targeted therapy, BRAF inhibitors, presumably. 20% were in the first line after the trial. Further trials were participated by 13.8% of patients. 25% of patients had ipilimumab, so effectively a crossover. And 25% of patients also had a combination CTLA-4 and PD-1. So in terms of the discussion of this TILS trial, it's a fascinating trial and a fascinating approach. And it does show a PFS and OS benefit of TILS over ipilimumab. The study enrolled patients who were both untreated and pretreated for unresectable and metastatic melanoma. 9 patients were untreated and 17 patients in the TILS group had received only adjuvant PD-1. So small numbers, but it is important. And this raises an interesting ethical question as well. Recruitment for this study started in September of 2014 and ceased in March of 2022. The data from CheckMate 067, that's the pivotal Ipi-Nivo trial, overall survival data was published in 2017. There's no breakdown of when patients were recruited, but if you are a patient who has untreated, like those nine patients were, and you are faced with either a unproven trial therapy or ipilimumab, which had already been superseded by that point, versus the established ipi and nevo, is it ethical to even offer patients that? And it very well could be, because there are only nine, that these patients were enrolled before the CheckMate 067 data came out. So the timelines are important, but it does raise ethical considerations about enrollment in both this trial and trials in general, that you have to basically make sure that you're doing the best and offering the best for your patients.
And it's the hard thing of being an adaptable trial where new data comes out, but your trial was designed off something from 4 years previously, and the world's moving and racing ahead, and you're kind of trying to do the best by your patients and the sponsors. It's all it's a muddy water, a muddy ethics, really.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it leads to trials doing protocol
amendments.
We saw that with Enzamet when docetaxel came out.
And yeah.
So it's not necessarily an issue, because I'm sure the authors found a way around it in terms of, you know, not recruiting patients who were untreated after CheckMate 067 came out, for example. But it is something to note. There was significant toxicity related to the administration of TILs, but this was not unexpected. In fact, it was by design. Practically speaking, though, if you're looking at what goes into this treatment, the amount of resources and the amount of personnel and lab space and surgeons that would be required to enroll this or roll this out in a sort of wide general population would be huge.
Yeah.
And so, and
labor intensive,
very labor intensive. And you can sort of scale that up to a country like Australia, which has one of the highest rates of melanoma in the world. You're going to have more customers.
You're going to have a center. Like, it's going to have to be a high volume center, which has its limitations, because then anyone regionally or rurally or doesn't live close to that center will have to go to that center for subsequent treatment.
Yeah.
You know, that's also an ethical consideration. Is there a way of being able to do it in a box?
Yeah, exactly. And it makes it difficult, and it raises logistical questions. Patients who had a BRAF mutated disease appeared to do better, although this was according to a post-hoc survival analysis, so take it with a grain of salt. But that means that if that is the case, ongoing work needs to be done for patients with BRAF wild-type disease, because, you know, we're still not kicking the goals that we would hope for those patients.
You okay, Michael?
It is interesting that the health-related quality of life outcomes were better overall in the TILS group, given the heavy initial therapy, but this raises the question about whether toxicity is not prolonged. You have your treatment and then you sort of forget about it. Overall, though, to summarise this study, it is a fascinating application of a novel anti-tumour technology, but there are several hurdles still remaining that keep it from being a more widely used therapy. It will be interesting to see if this is something that can be expanded, if it can be compared specifically to first-line therapy, and where it will slot in if it becomes possible.
Yeah, really, really fast. You got the better trial. You just got a really nice trial. Mine was like, all right, it's existing medications, it somewhat works.
But yours is probably more applicable in the short term.
In the short term, definitely probably more applicable. But yeah, even so, the data, for at least both of our trials, there's still questions that remain. But stay tuned, because next week we're going to talk about which CDK inhibitor is best. Is it palbociclib?
No.
Michael, we've got to be serious here. Is it ribociclib? He's not going to say anything. Maybe. Is it abemaciclib?
Probably.
Is it a new generation of CDKs that we're yet to see?
Maybe. Yes. Who knows?
Stay tuned and we'll see you then.
Bye. Thank you for listening to this episode of Oncology for the Inquisitive Mind. If you like this episode, there's plenty more where that came from. Check out our website, inquisitiveonk.com, that's inquisitiveonk.com, for links to all of our previous episodes. You'll find links to our social media there as well. If you'd like a particular subject covered on the show, feel free to drop us a line on Twitter at inquisitiveonk or via email at inquisitiveonk@gmail.com. This has been Oncology for the Inquisitive Mind, a podcast by ADC Productions.